On ABC Radio Hobart and across Tasmania, The Country Hour with Larissa Smith.
Nice to have you along this lunch hour. You might have heard of powdered broccoli in coffee. What about trying Brussels sprouts or even cauliflower in your latte? On the program today, we'll meet a couple of farmers trying to tap into the latest food trend, powdered vegetables.
It's very good for export because you're away from a perishable. It has a shelf life of up to, 18 months, 2 years. So I thought this could be done if we dehydrate it.
And speaking of shelf life, Woolworths is turning to local researchers to find new ways of keeping fruit and veg fresher for longer.
The needs of the producers, the retailers and the consumers are quite aligned. I think everyone's after reduced waste. I think everyone wants to see longer shelf life and greater supply chains. Perhaps an under-realised element of better supply chains is that it means that we can get our products from Tasmania right around the country and we can, help become the delicatessen of Australia that we're aiming to be.
We'll head inside the lab and look at those preservation technologies in about 10 minutes' time. But let's kick off with dairy first, because the global head of dairy giant Saputo has admitted input costs for dairy farmers are not matching the revenue they're getting for their milk. Lino Saputo Jr. is in Australia to talk to suppliers about the global market, milk prices and the future outlook. He told Jess Davis he'll also speak with former Murray Goulburn suppliers about sourcing more milk for the company and believes its opening milk price is responsible.
Well, I think we're in a very good industry. If you think about the prospects for consumers consuming more dairy, it's very good. The production is growing, however, at a more rapid rate than consumption. And that's really the problem, not just here in Australia, but all over the world. I think here in Australia, Saputo, through our entities of WCB and MG, have paid a leading price for dairy over the course of the last 4 or 5 milk years. We intend to do so moving forward. But I think the issue is larger than just Australia. I think in the world markets, there needs to be a better balance between supply and demand, and I've taken it upon myself to be one of the leaders of the industry to get the message out to producers around the world, not just here in Australia, about being a bit more responsible in terms of how much milk they're going to be producing and how many solids are coming off the farm.
There's been a lot of discussion about the opening milk prices here over the last few weeks. There's some cautious optimism over your offer of $5.75 a kilo. Can you give us indications of what the closing price for the season might be, or what guarantees you can give farmers that there won't be any step downs into the future?
Well, guarantees about step down, of course, is something that is fundamental to us. And this is why we opened up at $5.75. I think it's a very responsible price. I think it gives the suppliers an indication of what number they can build their budgets around. In terms of closing price, I can look at some of the economics and economists' surveys of where they think the markets are going. If I look at what's going on around the world, there are three regions that are the regions that influence the amount of solids available for the emerging markets. You've got the United States, you have Europe, and you have New Zealand. And I know farmers in all of those regions are suffering. So milk is coming off the table. The provisions for better economics, I think, are there. At this stage, I would not venture out into what I think the closing price would be. But I would say that the fundamentals in the industry are getting better. So there is optimism in the industry.
Despite the fact that $5.75 is an okay price, in Australia, a lot of farmers are suffering because hay this season has been very expensive. Electricity prices continue to rise. And so returns just aren't there, even if there is a reasonable milk price. How do we get around that?
Yeah, I'm aware of that. And I truly do feel for the suppliers. They've got their input costs that are going up, and their revenues don't seem to be going up at the same rate. It's a very, very tough situation. In fact, when I visit suppliers, not just here in Australia, but all over the world, they're all talking about the economics and how difficult they are. I'm hoping that the markets will recover in the emerging markets, and that demand will continue to be strong. And if the supply and demand balance aligns itself well, then I think that, you know, that pricing can be well over $6.
And you actually want to increase supply here in Australia. Why is that, and how do you plan on doing it?
Well, we were running our WCB plant at 98% capacity utilization, so we're quite full and quite efficient there. Assets that we acquired through Murray Goulburn are running at around 58% capacity utilization. There's one way that we can be more effective and more efficient, and that is by passing more solids through our plants. And so that's what our initiative is. So while I'm out here in Australia, we're meeting with all of our suppliers, and we're talking about opening price, and we're talking about market conditions. Of course, we talk about Saputo's culture and values and character. But we're also doing that with prospective suppliers. So as part of the meetings we're having as we're going through these four states, there are meetings that we're having with prospective buyers and hoping that they come back to their natural home, which is MG.
Let's go to processing. Do you have a time frame for the sale of the Koroit factory in southwest Victoria?
No time frame, but the process is underway. There was quite a bit of interest in the first round. We had a total of about seven or eight potential buyers that are not just Australian, but we did have some foreign interest that also indicated their level of interest to acquire the Koroit plant. Over the course of the process, we narrowed that down to a handful of buyers that I think are able to bring this process to the finish line. No time frame yet has been determined, but things are progressing extremely well.
So can we expect an announcement soon about who that buyer might be?
I think so, yes. Yeah, I think by the end of this calendar year, the asset will be sold, and I'm hoping that in short order we'll be able to announce who the prospective buyer is.
Let's move back to Canada now.
Yes.
Canada and the US are currently in renegotiations over the North America Free Trade Agreement. So we've seen Donald Trump rail against Canada's tariffs on US dairy imports and the protected dairy industry, despite it being a comparatively minor part of this agreement. What do you make of dairy getting caught up in this, and what effect will it have on your business?
Yeah, so let me say that our home base is Canada, and our head office still is in one of the provinces in Canada. And so that is a contentious issue between the dairy farmers of Canada and the dairy farmers in the United States. I don't think that the dairy farmers in the U.S. really are opposed to Canada's milk supply managed system. What they're opposed to is the unfair practice that Canada has employed over the course of the last 2 years with a new class of milk, which is called Class 7. Even though Canada is my home base, I agree with the American dairy farmers on this one. I think that Canada can maintain their milk supply managed system, but they can have both sides of the world where they've got a protected system in Canada, and then they've got a class of milk that allows them to compete in the rest of the world. I'm not in favor of that. I think Class 7 should be abolished, and I think that that would resolve the a negotiation issue, at least on the dairy file. I'm not making a lot of friends in the farming community in Canada when I say that, but I think it's the most responsible thing that Canada can do for its industry.
Can you please explain Class 7? Because I've read about it and I've tried to understand, but it's quite a complicated system.
So we have a classing price system in Canada. So Class 1 would be fluid milk, the highest cost of milk for us. Class 2 would be milk that goes into products like yogurt. Class 3 would be milk that goes into cheese. Class 4 would be powder. And so as you go down the classes, the cost of milk is cheaper. Well, now down at the bottom of the barrel, you got a Class 7. And Class 7 allows us to have dairy solids in Canada at world prices. And so if there aren't enough consumers in Canada for those solids, the excess of those solids will go into the world market. So Canada is competing with countries like Australia, New Zealand, United States, and Europe. But they've got their protected system for Class 1 to Class 4, and yet they've got an open market system for Class 7. So it seems like Canada wants its cake and wants to eat it too. And I don't think that that's a fair practice. I think that around the world, when I make these statements, most of the dairy farmers are in favor of my sentiments. The Canadian dairy farmers are not, because they like to keep everything intact. And I don't think that we can get out of this NAFTA negotiation keeping the entire dairy file intact as it is.
Thank you for explaining that so simply.
Pleasure.
You're the spokesperson for your company in Australia, which makes it very difficult for the Australian media to get a hold of you when you're not here and sitting in front of us, which we love. Are you planning on appointing a spokesperson here in Australia so that when you have an opening milk price, we do have someone we can go to talk to about
it? Absolutely, yes. Yeah. So we do in other regions, whether it's the United States or in Argentina, we do have spokespeople through our communications team. We thought, though, that as we were going through the process of MG, that we speak with one voice. And I think that it has served us well. We certainly don't want to get misrepresented. And so through the course of the acquisition in 9 months, I had been to Australia about 7 times. And I made myself available all 7 times for media interviews and requests. As we move forward, of course, I'll probably come back to Australia twice a year, usually the month of June, July, when we have the opening milk price, and the month of February, when I have the opportunity to visit with our plant employees and market industry leaders. So, yes, there will be somebody appointed locally so that you can have some answers to your questions.
We'll look forward to that. Now, I have a couple of audience-submitted questions that I'll ask you.
Sure.
What does Australian dairy need to do in order to meet the potential you saw when Saputo invested in the Australian dairy industry when you bought Warrnambool Cheese and Butter?
What does the industry need to do? I think the industry is in fine shape. I will tell you that around the world, when you think about exporting Australian dairy solids into the emerging markets, all consumers recognize the value of Australian dairy in terms of its quality, in terms of the farming system, its heritage and lineage. Nothing that Australia needs to do more than what it is currently doing. I think the onus is on all of the other dairy producing countries around the world to make sure that there's a good balance of supply and demand so that we can get the revenues at the farm level that much higher. I've always said this, without a strong farming community, we don't have an industry. Without milk, all we have is brick and mortar and stainless steel. And we're not in the brick and mortar and stainless steel business. So we do need the solids coming off the farm, and we need the economics at the farm level to be much better.
This was my favorite question that came from Twitter. Who cuts your hair? It's immaculate.
I'd like to say that my wife helps me trim my hair, but I do have a barber back in Montreal. If any of you come to Montreal, I'll give you his name and he'll be happy to cut your hair.
Thanks very much, Lino Saputo, for your time today on the Country Hour.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Lino Saputo Jr. talking to Jess Davis about milk prices, the future of the dairy industry, and his hair, more importantly. Have you noticed if lamb has increased in price when you've been shopping for meat? Well, shortly we'll take a look at the stellar run lamb's having in the eastern states and what's pushing those prices north. But before that, retailers have their work cut out to keep fruit and vegetables fresh and visually appealing after it's travelled long distances. And with growing consumer opposition to plastic in stores, companies like Woolworths are turning to researchers to find environmentally friendly ways to extend the shelf life of their produce. It's commissioned research fellow Dr. Matt Wilson and a UTAS PhD student to look into these preservation technologies.
We're aware that supply chains for a country as large as Australia can be both a challenge, I mean quite an exciting challenge, but it means getting products right around Australia all year round means that we have to come up with new and exciting ways to move products around the place, that our existing technologies don't work. They're too reliant on products like plastics or single-use polystyrene that we're trying to get rid of. And so we come to the approach of how can we get foods lasting longer and in better condition when they get to the consumer.
So this is part of a broader national project that you're working on?
That's right. So it's based here at the University of Tasmania, but we have 10 PhD students working right around Australia on a whole diverse range of products affecting the Australian horticultural industry, from mango resin canal issues to potato greening to banana supply chain issues, but right down to local Tasmanian products like berries and broccoli that Nyat is working on with her PhD today. So this is Ki Nyat Hun. She is from PhD student from Vietnam. I'm very excited to have her here in Tasmania. And her goal is specifically to look at ways that packaging and other post-harvest treatments can positively extend the shelf life and reduce waste of key Tasmanian products.
What's the issue with getting broccoli from the farm to the store?
Now they're shipping in the polystyrene box, and they're topping with ice. Polystyrene box, not environmental friendly. It's very hard to recycle. And when topping with ice, then when it comes to the retailer, then the ice melts, and it will just create damage to the broccoli itself. And the temperature during transportation is very hard to maintain, so that's one also affect the shelf life of broccoli. By the time it gets to the store, it doesn't good anymore. Mm-hmm. The broccoli is very susceptible to yellowing the florid, so that's what I'm looking at, trying to remove the ice but also keep the quality of the broccoli.
The two methods that you've been trying so far?
Two main methods involve new packaging innovations. For example, we've got some biopolymers made from recyclable or non-petroleum-based plastic materials. And we've also been exploring different active methods, like changing the gas ratios within the package, within treatments, or using ethylene scavengers or similar products to positively influence the shelf life of the broccoli. So we're generating our own modified atmosphere at a very specific setting. That's what this equipment enables us to do. And it means that we can try innovative treatments that might be being passed down to industry on a very large scale, but we can replicate them here in our lab on quite a small scale and do some very detailed testing of how those effects might change for a product like broccoli.
How would the modified atmosphere, how much would it increase the shelf life by?
That will depend on the products, and our test is still working on that, but we know from other products that you can have considerable extensions, anywhere up to 50% extra shelf life for some fresh products we're aware of.
Yep.
From our experience, retailers are very keen for different ideas that will reduce the need for both for packaging, excess packaging, and for waste. And so they're very happy to support us, trial new technologies that will achieve both of those aims.
What other vegetable or fruits could you apply these technologies to?
The range is almost endless. In general, we're focusing here on the high-value products, and we're hoping that the extra margins and ability that the high price allows us to transfer them down to other more commodity-style products. But for the moment, highly respiring products like broccoli, like berries, like cherries might be the key target for now.
Why are you passionate about finding solutions to the problems of supermarkets and food manufacturers, the supply chain?
Very personally, because I love veggies and I love fruit, and I hate seeing food waste too much. Like every day, the amount of food waste is just magnificent. And I came from a developing country, so I know there's out there many people they don't have enough food to put on the table. But so I hope I can learn something and then can be part of the solution to that.
Do you find it challenging as scientists to find the right balance of the needs of consumers and the needs of the retailers, the people that are producing the food?
In this case, I think that the needs of the producers, the retailers and the consumers are quite aligned. I think everyone's after reduced waste. I think everyone wants to see longer shelf life and greater supply chains. Perhaps an under-realised element of better supply chains is that it means that we can get our products from Tasmania right around the country, and we can, you know, help become the delicatessen of Australia that we're aiming to be.
Matt Wilson is a research fellow with the ARC Training Centre for Innovative Horticultural Products. He was talking there about some local shelf life and quality research. To livestock now, and lamb prices are in uncharted territory, surpassing 720 cents per kilogram in the eastern states. In the past year, the value of sheep exports was $3.7 billion, accounting for more than 7% of the value of Australia's food exports. Rural Bank analyst Michael Curtis says the sheep meat industry has been experiencing an extraordinary run, despite production dropping in 2017.
Yeah, so production did drop in 2017, so that followed 5 years of growing production, and production in 2017 was still 15% higher than 2012, so a longer term trend in growth.
And the other thing that's interesting about this, Michael, is that the domestic consumption of lamb hasn't really changed that much.
Yeah, that's right. Domestic consumption of lamb has been very stable for quite a while. So all of the growth that we're seeing in demand has come from export markets, to the point now where lamb exports are equivalent to 50% of production. And looking at mutton, exports are equivalent to just under 90% of production. So becoming heavily reliant on export markets there, and it's the growth in markets such as China, the US and the Middle East, and also some Southeast Asia markets are starting to join the party as well. Growth in those markets is what's really driving demand and helping push up prices.
Am I right in saying that in the past year, China actually overtook the US as our number one market for lamb exports?
Yeah, that's correct. On a volume basis, China overtook the US. They increased their intake of Australian lamb quite substantially, and at the same time, the price that they were paying for that increased as well. So we saw a 63% increase in the value of lamb exports to China, and that took it to $265 million for the year in 2017.
What does this all mean for producers? How much do they get to take home?
This story's sort of culminated in a record price for lamb achieved last week. So we saw the Eastern States Trade Lamb Indicator reach a high of 726 cents per kilogram on Wednesday last week. And producers are enjoying some really good returns at the moment. We've seen that translate into sale yard prices increasing, and that's been increasing for quite a while.
What does that mean for the national flock?
Yeah, so the flock's been declining for quite a while, and as we've moved from a predominant merino wool producing flock to more prime lamb production, we've seen the numbers come down. There was a slight increase in the flock last year, and producers would have entered 2018 with the intentions of increasing flock sizes to take advantage of high prices for both sheep meat and wool that's on offer at the moment. This year, due to dry conditions, we've seen an increased turnoff of stock, and we'll expect that to translate to probably a reduction in the flock again. Producers' intentions are definitely there to increase the flock when conditions allow.
And I note too, Michael, as part of the report, you found that the live sheep export contributes almost $250 million to the economy, accounting for 31% of Western Australia's sheep and lamb offtake in the last year.
Is an important part of the industry, as you say, contributing just under $250 million in export value. And yes, particularly more important over in WA, where they account for a higher proportion of sheep and lamb offtake.
Michael Curtis from Rural Bank following its Australian Lamb and Sheep Meat Annual Review. He was speaking with Kath Sullivan. When it comes to deciding which female sheep to keep, producers have been advised to get rid of the passengers and keep the performers. John Young has been studying the selection of ewes and says good decisions about which ones to hang on to can save farmers more than $300 per animal. He told Michael Condon there's a big concern at the moment around the rebuilding of the national flock.
We're quite focused on increasing reproduction rate in the national flock because the national flock has sort of shrunk so much in the last sort of 20 years. So we've been looking at reproduction and how that can be increased. And there's been some research that was done a little while ago that showed that there's a big difference in performance from the best ewes in the flock to the poorest ewes in the flock. And so we were trying to, to quantify that, there was about a $350 per ewe difference in their lifetime between the best ewes and the worst ewes. And a lot of that was related to reproduction. And we're trying to work out whether we can get some of that $350 into the farmer's pocket.
So, and what sort of things do you need to look for? They've got the genomic index, but I guess you're just looking at it. It's more of a physical representation. You're actually looking at the animals and making decisions there.
Yes. So we're the bit we're looking at, and this is really only part of the jigsaw, but we're looking at how you can select your ewes, not so much from a genetic point of view, but just for the rest of their lifetime. So it's more of a phenotypic way of looking at things, but looking at ewes that have failed to rear a lamb in the first couple of years, selling them, and then later in their life, the ewes that have produced a lamb, or even better, of two lambs each year of their life, to retain them in the flock for an extra year.
Must be hard, though, when you look at the pricing and to actually making those decisions. And, you know, they're expensive animals we're talking about here. That some people would be loath to be making those hard decisions.
Yeah, so sometimes the good prices actually works in favour of selling some animals, because at least they're going off the farm and you're getting some high prices for them. So it's often harder to cull them when prices are low. But we certainly aren't saying cull your flock down and make it smaller. It's part of a sell some of the passengers, that's what we're calling the ones that aren't performing, sell them earlier and then retain the performers for an extra year or two.
So, but I mean, I guess the thing is that this season hasn't been ideal, so people are, you know, having to make that decision to reduce numbers anyway, particularly in those drought-affected areas of New South Wales.
Yes, and if animals do have to be sold, then we're certainly thinking you can prioritise which sheep should go off the farm first, and looking at
the
previous
ones that aren't the doers, the ones that aren't as productive, get rid of them first.
Yes, yeah, they're the highest priority to get off the farm, or the lowest priority to keep on the farm.
Yep. Okay. Well, I guess that's an interesting topic to be talking about when people are basically having to sell everything at the moment in some parts of the state.
Yes. I guess the problem might be that we're just a little bit late delivering this message, because you did need to have done some assessment of your animals already in order to know that whether they've produced lambs in the past or not. So it does take a year or two to actually get into the system that we're proposing.
Although when people are having difficult years, it's sometimes hard for people to make those sort of rational decisions, or hard to really think about those things when they've sort of got a fog of drought. It's hard to, switch the brain around that way.
Yes, yeah, it is very difficult. So it's certainly something that we want people to think about and implement over time, so that next time there's a drought, that the ideas about how to respond to that drought are actually part of the psyche, and it's not a decision that has to be made at the time. The decision was already made. All you're doing is implementing the.
And the flock you've got is one that can bounce back a lot faster than something else, than another flock that might have just been saddled with.
Yes, that's definitely the case. If you've got a high reproduction rate, you can bounce back. We're certainly not thinking that what we're suggesting is the whole story to getting high reproduction rates. There's a lot of other management involved, sort of nutrition, hitting condition score targets, making sure you're setting up your lambing paddocks, allocating sheep to lambing paddocks well. So it's all part of a package.
That's sheep producer John Young with some advice on selecting ewes, especially in dry times where it has been on the mainland in New South Wales and Queensland. Up ahead, landing that export deal, a Northwest business specialising in preserves, will step us through the process after securing a buyer for their product in Sri Lanka. Plus, we'll meet a couple new to pig farming in Tassie and embracing community-supported agriculture.
You went to the farmer and picked up your meat and they did everything there. So that was the plan when we moved down. I really wanted to get into that whole side of things and, experimentation with, sausage flavours and any of those kind of things. We want to try and use as many local Tassie ingredients as we can.
The crew behind Fork It Farm at Labrina coming up in around 15 minutes from now. But now time for the latest on the weather with Anna Forrest at the Bureau. Anna, any rainfall in the gauge?
There's been a little bit around, particularly Mount Reid has had up to 18 millimetres up until 9 o'clock this morning, and just about 5 millimetres at Port Arthur and 3 millimetres at Queenstown. But since 9 o'clock, 3 millimetres at Low Rocky Point, 2 millimetres at Cape Sorrel and 1 millimetre at Strawn, otherwise nothing to talk about. So it's fairly concentrated into the west, and it's likely to stay there for the rest of the day. So not much over most of the state.
So fairly fine this afternoon then, by the sounds of it.
Yes, there's the cold front coming up onto us. It will actually increase the frequency of showers into the west and might push them right through Bass Strait as well. But otherwise, it's not going to do much for any of us in the way of precipitation. Might see something along the coastal fringe early hours of tomorrow morning, particularly around the northern coastal areas, but otherwise it's just going to be frosty in the inland areas again overnight and then fine again tomorrow. Not a great deal of variation in the weather for the rest of the week, really. There's a high-pressure system sitting over southeast Australia and it's forcing approaching fronts to weaken and move to the south, and we're not seeing much out of them. So up until middle of the weekend at this stage, it's looking steady as she goes.
And would there be much in the weekend as far as rain is concerned?
At this stage, there's a front coming through Saturday, but it's getting later and later each time we look at the outlooks. So might not make it through until late-ish or middle of the day on Sunday. That'll start to bring some shower activity through, so Sunday might be a little bit damp. And then when early part of the week, next week at this stage, is looking very, very windy and wet about the north and west particularly. But because it's such strong winds, they might actually force precipitation into the rest of the state as well. So we'll just have to wait and see for that. But up until then, dominated by the high-pressure systems with fleeting changes of frequency of showers into the west and north.
Okay, today's swell and coastal waters.
Okay, so we're looking at west-southwesterly winds at 10 to 20 knots over much of the state at the moment. It's going to increase around the southwest overnight tonight up to about 20 to 30 knots. Seas will stay at 1 to 2 metres, rise to 2 to 2.5 in the south tonight. And then tomorrow, northwest-westerly winds at 10 to 20 knots will tend northerly about the west and north during the morning and go variable elsewhere in the afternoon up to about 10 knots. Seas currently, as I said, 1 to 2 metres. They'll stay that way over much of it of the area tomorrow and slowly drop out into the evening to be below a metre pretty much generally. Swells in the west and south are southwesterlies, 3 to 4 metres today, 3 to 3.5 tomorrow. Across the northwesterlies below a metre both days, and up the east coast we're looking at southerlies 1 to 2 metres today, slightly lower tomorrow 1 to 1.5 metres, and decaying during the course of the day. The wave ride is currently on 3 metres, or 3.1 metres if you want to be deadly accurate, with a max at 5.2 and a 12-second period. So,
and what about warnings?
Not too bad. We have one strong wind warning for the southwest coastal waters, southeast Cape to Low Rocky Point for today, and that is it.
Great. Thank you so much, Anna.
You're welcome.
It's the Country Hour with Larissa Smith on ABC Radio Hobart and across Tasmania.
He told me the only person to change you is you. I listened.
Do you know a young person with a story to tell?
Eating disorder. A diagnosis. Deep down, something I'd longed for.
AWARA is looking for stories about what it's like growing up in regional Australia.
There are lots of dams where my family love to go swimming.
Winners get their story featured on the ABC and win an all-expenses-paid trip to the AWARA Regional Youth Summit in Canberra.
I met new people. I learnt new things.
Entries are open now. Go to abc.net.au/AWARA.
It's 20 to 1 on the Tasmanian Country Hour. How do local food producers seal the deal to export to Asia? For Northwest Business Hill Farm Preserves, it all started with a trade show. Business Development Manager Stephanie Jentsch says it's now sending product to a new client in Sri Lanka, less than 3 months after attending Food and Hotel Asia.
When we went, it was actually right on the back of being announced as a state winner in the Delicious Produce Award. So we knew that we had something to brag about and something to catch the eye of people. And differentiating yourself in market is really important. So we needed something to elevate our product and catch the eye. So we knew that and were so thrilled that one of our canola oils, which is actually infused with native pepper berry, was the biggest hit of all. It's so unusual, and being able to capture the imagination of buyers, once we've caught their eye, catching the imagination and then having them taste it was the things which really sealed the deal in interest.
Can you describe what it's like once you're there at the trade show?
It's one of the most frightening things, turning up into halls probably, you know, three times the size of Princess Wharf, you know, and there are 12 or 13 different halls altogether. Just an extraordinary number of people from all over the world who are there selling their wares. As you were seeing people walk past and do a double take because they went, oh, it's Tasmania. Oh, tell me about that. Oh, what's your product? It was quite a deal of excitement, and that's really hard to, you're not immune to that excitement level as people are discovering you for the first time.
So you went in with zero expectations, and yeah. What did you sort of come away with from the trade show itself?
So one of the things that in preparing to go to a trade show like this, the Department of State Growth were excellent in being able to make available somebody who's an expert in this, in dealing with trade shows and how to approach it. And for a newbie like Hill Farm, who's never been to a trade show before ever, that was an invaluable resource. And one of the tips that was given to us was, you know, it's all about the follow-up. You need to be able to record who it is that you're meeting, take notes as much as you possibly can about their physical appearance so you can remember who it is you're talking to, what they were interested in, and then when you get home, as soon as possible after you arrive back in Tasmania, make contact with those that are that took the time to speak to you and to have an exchange with. And that was certainly something that we took very seriously, and so within 2 weeks of arriving home, emails had gone out to every one of those real contacts that we'd made and had contact back from every one of them as well. And of those, we had amazing hit rates because we were able to personalise the contact and the communication with them and give them what they needed.
What is the arrangement you've now got with that client?
10 weeks after meeting the Sri Lankan company in Singapore, we last Friday sent away the very first of what we hope is a long-standing relationship with them. But they are very excited, particularly for our mustard products, our unique flavours in the range, and have secured a retail space in an outlet which is one of Colombo's and Sri Lanka's leading wine merchants in the premium space for our products. So we're very happy with that. And what that does is also highlight, it's aligning premium products together. So, you know, when you are going and getting your wine and you can pick up these beautiful gourmet products at the same time, you know, that sounds great to us.
At Stephanie Yench, the Business Development Manager for Hill Farm Preserves, which is now exporting to Sri Lanka along with Japan and South Korea. She was speaking there to Margot Kelly. Well, if your kids aren't eating enough veggies, would you buy them powdered and add them to a meal instead? Powdered broccoli is already being added to coffee. Now a New South Wales farming couple, Quentin and Leslie Bland, are taking a punt on the latest trend and are turning broccoli, cauliflower and even Brussels sprouts into powder.
We've been in the market gardening for a long time, as generations. I started through school and when we left school, and we went into the broccoli, and then just the last few years, because of the markets require a pretty high quality, there's always a lot of waste. So we decided we might try another outlet for the waste product, which then lent itself towards the dehydration process. I went into a health food shop a couple of years ago and saw all these products and thought, well, why aren't we doing something like that? So it slowly evolved into what we have now. We've built the factory on the farm and there we are.
So what part of the broccoli gets wasted normally?
Well, for the market, sometimes if the heads aren't really good, they're thrown away. And then also when we looked into it, all the stalk and leaf is very high in nutrient. So that's where the idea of the plant came from, to utilise the lot.
How did you think about, and where did the idea come from to turn it into powder?
Probably just speaking to a lot of people and hearing on the news, you know, how the broccoli food was the rage for the superfoods, the whole marketing process there. It's very good for export because you're away from a perishable. It has a shelf life of up to, you know, 18 months, 2 years. So I thought this could be done if we dehydrate it. So we went from there. We purchased a low temperature dehydrator, which keeps all the enzymes in the product.
So what's the process? So you go around the farm, pick broccoli. How do you then turn it into powder?
The broccoli's harvested in the paddock, then it's brought back into the shed, the packing house, and then it's all washed and trimmed. If there's any bad leaves or anything, we throw that aside. Then it goes into what's called a comatrol, which cuts it into a fine 5 mil cut, then it's placed on trays, put into the dehydrator, then it's milled on from there. It takes about 14 hours to dry the product.
And so how much broccoli are you picking and how much are you turning into powder?
It's about 10 to 1. Like the broccolis, or most veggies, are about 90% water and the rest is your product.
So through the dehydration process and turning it into powder, you'd lose nearly all of the water?
That's right. It's dehydrated and then you just end up with this fine powder.
So I've got the powder, what do I do with it?
Yes, well, I think my favourite way of using the powder is mixing it with a miso paste in a soup, in a cup. It's like a nutrition bomb. It's absolutely delicious. Smoothies are fantastic for your breakfast smoothie if you want that extra protein. I've been trialling with some bread, which is absolutely fantastic.
Broccoli powder bread.
Yeah, just, beautiful with blue cheese.
Really?
Absolutely, yeah, delicious.
Did you ever think you'd get into this kind of line of work where you'd be turning your prized broccolis into a form of powder?
No, not really. 5 years ago, we really hadn't thought about it at all. We knew down the track we may have to value add or do something somewhere. Doing this, hopefully, for the next generations, you know, the boys coming through, one of them might go, oh, we'll work on the farm, Dad.
That'd be very nice, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would. At the moment, it's a hard call.
Hard call as in, you're taking a bit of a gamble here just to try something new with the farm?
Oh, I think so. It'll take a while to get the markets and get it through to the, you know, I think we have to go not only locally but offshore. So that's what we're working on now.
Is it a mixture of excitement and a little bit nervous as well?
Yes. Yeah, it's interesting journey because it is a bit of a gamble, but we feel it's a really, really important opportunity to try something new and something that will hopefully keep the farm viable and so we can keep it in the family, keep it going.
Quentin and Leslie Bland of Coconnell Farm near Bathurst in New South Wales talking to Tim Fuchs about turning their broccoli into powder. I'm still not sold on the broccoli powder in your coffee.
The August issue of ABC Gardening Australia magazine is full of floral action. Soak up the colour of the carnival of flowers, celebrate the beauty of magnolias and learn how to jazz up a flower border. Get help with growing tricky fruits, see how to get tomatoes and other spring veg off to an early start, and check out the cutest small wattles. Need a hedge in a hurry? Here's 10 great choices for a fast result. Gardening Australia magazine, available from newsagents and abcshop.com.au.
On ABC Radio Hobart and across Tasmania, this is The Country Hour with Larissa Smith.
Now to turning over a new leaf in Tassie, Daniel and Kim Croker left desk jobs in Brisbane last year to begin a new life as pig farmers at Labrina in the state's northeast. Their Berkshire pigs are raised on open pasture at Forkett Farm and they're part of the CSA network supporting local farmers in the community. Hilary Burden caught up with the pair to learn more about their fledgling whole hog box venture.
I am driving the garbage truck to help keep ends meeting till we start getting some money in.
Grammy's making some good sounds.
Yeah, I know.
What's the setup here?
So we have 10 yards in a cartwheel shape so that we can rotate the pigs through. We have 52 pigs at the moment, 9 sows, 1 boar. And we have a small herd of cattle and sheep.
And what are you doing with the pigs?
So we've set up a CSA program, a community supported agriculture. So what we plan, what we do with that is we give everyone orders a hog share and they get a monthly delivery of pork. So they set it up for, they sign up for a 6 month period and they get 3 kilos a month. And that's broken down between fresh cuts of pork, so ground cuts like mince or sausages. And then also some smoked goods as well, so hams, bacon, salamis, all that kind of yummy small goods stuff. So, yeah, that's the plan at the moment. And we plan to rotate the cuts per season and per month, as well as, like, our sausage flavours that'll change every month. And we want to We want to use as much of the pig as we can. So the whole idea is to give everyone a bit of different cut every month so they can get to try different things. And any of the different kind of cuts, we all supply a recipe card with them so people can have a suggestion for what they could do with them.
Well, they're mad for the apples.
Yes. Oh, charming.
Was that the sound of a big fart?
Yes, that was a big fart.
That was a big fart for you. Just adding to the sound effects, aren't you? They get a grain as well, so right. They get that every 3 days. We give them grain for 3 days' worth.
Right.
Just makes it a bit easier for them.
You've just started doing the deliveries of your whole hog boxes. What's happening today?
So we're doing our first deliveries into the Lilydale area. We're hoping... We've got two customers there, so that'll be great. So, and we're doing our home deliveries so we can get to meet our customers as well. We really want that relationship with our customers.
We've got some pork products in the Eskies, and we're going to make some our first deliveries to our Lilydale customers.
What would you be doing in Brisbane now compared to what you're doing here?
Probably finally looking forward to the weekend so we could get out in the backyard and play in the garden, and we just nearly run into one of our neighbours. It's been a really supportive community. We've met all the neighbours. We even went to the first street party last weekend. Met some great street people through Tas Women in Ag. So it's, yeah, really good to have those connections. And they're really honest connections, not like in the city where sometimes they can be a little bit fake. Okay, we're arriving at Gordon's place now. We'll just stop and get his pack out the boot. Hi, Gordon.
Oh, hey, Kim. Dad, how are you?
Good, mate. How are you? Just here really with your hog share delivery for the month.
Fantastic. This is the first one. Oh, this is so exciting.
And because you guys signed up for a year, we gave you a bonus as well.
I put some
smoked hocks in that in there for the soup.
Bonus bones.
Yeah, bonus smoked bones for some pea and ham soup.
Oh, that's great. I'm so pleased to be doing this because when we were doing pigs here and, you know, like the guests from the Trig staying at the Trig, they loved it. Unless it's managed really well, the effect on the environment can be devastating.
Yep.
And knowing the way you guys do it with your rotational paddocks and... is just a great way to do it. So I'm happy to be paying you to do that.
Yeah.
And be the recipient.
Fantastic. That's what we want to hear. Yeah.
And keeping the coin local.
That's the difference, isn't it? It's not just about having a home delivery.
Yeah.
It's much more than that.
Yeah, exactly. It's more than the product. It's actually about the community and the cohesiveness. And
And why can community service agriculture? What's the idea behind CSA, Kim?
The idea is just to have that connection with our customer, but it also allows us to control our cash flow a little better so that we know what we can produce and to make sure we can sustain what we're doing long term.
You're only new to farming, I understand, and new to Tasmania. Tell us a bit about your background and what leapt you into pig farming.
I did a Bachelor of Applied Science in Rural Technology, and then I did teaching. So I've done various roles in the education sector, and we just got sick of city life and earning money just to spend it again and not really having a purpose. So I decided to move to Tasmania from Queensland. Much nicer weather down here.
So, Daniel, a lot of work getting the farm up to scratch. You found 25 hectares in the northeast. What's been kind of the hardest thing to get your head around, I guess?
Oh, there's lots of things. But fencing was a new experience for me, doing fencing. So we've put about 12 kilometres of fencing in just for the pig paddocks. We're pretty lucky here. Previous owner had a lot of infrastructure already set up, so all our boundary fencing was good. We had water to the paddocks, which is great. So been a lot of fencing and just learning new skills and new roles.
Because you're an academic?
I'm previously a research academic, so it's a whole lot of new skills with me. But
are the farmers telling you?
Oh, yeah. I think I'm crazy, I think. But I've always liked working outdoors, and I've always built everything. And, you know, I think I'm pretty handy in that direction with building things, so I build all the pig sheds and everything like that as well. So that's been really good for me. And for me, it was 20 years stuck in a climate control, looking down a microscope and staring at computer screens. So this is fantastic to be outdoors and, you know, fresh air and all those wonderful things about being a farmer. So
there's lots of challenges, learning how quickly the pigs are going to go through the paddocks in the different seasons. And
how'd you come up with a name?
We were tossing up, did all these mind maps of what we were going to call the farm. I was sitting at work at lunch and went, fork it. We're saying fork it to our old life. And it kind of works with the whole farming and eating pork thing as well.
Be careful how you say it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah, this is the PG rated version of what we said to our old lives. So it works a lot better, but it's catchy as well, and people remember it.
What's going to be the sort of indicators of success for you in terms of how your business grows?
I really think having those customers return. So keeping customers is going to be the number one thing, but just getting their feedback and being able to keep it sustainable, not just environmentally wise, but financially, is the main goal. We don't want to get massive. We just want to produce good quality food.
Well, so the plan when we is to actually build on farm, so that we can build a boning room on farm, so I can do the butchering and everything on farm. As in part of that process is also building a commercial kitchen as well, so that we can do the value-added products. So we really want to make just small batch artisanal products. So we want to take the time to make things, do it right, and make them slowly and make them good. Just doing really old school dry cure techniques. So things like your classic pancettas, and and also buying on farm, I can have a lot more control about what we make, and we can respond to customers a lot easier if we have special requests and things like that. That's really what we're looking to do. It's not about discounting and selling to the cheapest and just trying to make money quickly. Obviously, it makes it a bit harder for us, but like Kim said, it's about education. And the other thing we learnt was, doing the on-farm processing and value adding is also one of the ways to really help the bottom line of the business. So,
like the good old days.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, you went to the farmer and picked up your meat and they did everything there. So that was the plan when we moved down. I really wanted to get into that whole side of things and, experimentation with, sausage flavours and any of those kind of things. We want to try and use as many local Tassie ingredients as we can. So things like local pepperberry farms and all that kind of stuff, incorporate that into our products as well. So if we can, as long as we can make enough money out of the farm to support us, we're happy. Mm.
Pig farmers Daniel and Kim Croker from Forkett Farm at Labrinna, speaking with reporter Hilary Burden. Coming up on tomorrow's Country Hour, Tasmanian farmers helping out their mainland cousins battling drought in western New South Wales.
The bloke who owned the property up north of Broken Hill, he said the drought back in the 60s was his benchmark. And he said that was bad. He said stock were laying down and dying everywhere. But he said, this one's worse. I myself don't know what the drought was like back in the 60s, but if this is worse, it can't have been real nice then, but just anywhere you look up there, you'll find dead stock. It's just a fact of life at the moment. As one bloke said to me, if you can, you sell them if you can, otherwise you smell them. Not a nice way to look at it, but it's just the reality of it. Hay is very scarce. Everyone's looking at options. Hay was around about the $200 a tonne 3-4 months ago. Companies bought up a lot of the surplus hay that was around, and they're selling that off at about between $400 and $500 a tonne. That's making things very tight for people. They're having to look at other options.
That's David Brown with Aussie Helpers. He's been working on a property north of Broken Hill with other Tasmanian farmers. We'll hear more about that experience on tomorrow's Country Hour.